right, folks, welcome to the Musky 360 podcast, a Jay Bird.
Well done, Steve. Well
yes,
done.
Yes, yes. The consistency there, boys. Anyway.
Beautiful tone.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice
tone.
To hear from you.
I've been on
yeah.
the phone all day. That's why
I've
been warmed up.
It's been a long week.
Well, it's, you know, we were just talking before we fired her off here. Mm-hmm. You know, you got the Northwoods fishing report for everybody coming up there, and Jay was just saying it's been helter skelter busy, isn't it, right now at the shop, and we're in the thick of it.
Yeah.
What's going on? Any comings and goings?
You know, we're coming up with the big 4th of July weekend. Talk about, about busy week. Yeah, just something else. So
I saw a lot of people getting out.
A lot of people getting up. A lot of people taking their kids out, which is awesome to see, and mm-hmm. you know, getting bluegills and all that. You know, we had a fun moment with last week with Jake Smith from Smitty Baits was mm-hmm. in, and we finished up and opened the office door and like, hey, thanks a lot, Jake, and bam, there's his son Charlie, his little 5-year-old, and
nice.
So we got him for a little sound bite because he loves to fish. So that was cool. And yep, trying to line up a guest or two this week. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll get the report. Well, if nothing else, getting the info for when you're rolling into town, you know,
yep.
and staying on top of it. And finally, the Canada boys of the Danny and Joe are as consistent as they can be. They're getting
good.
Them every week.
Good to hear.
So you got your reports like here through the thick of it. Anyway.
Overall, fishing's been very good.
Yep. Yeah,
and it's warming up a lot around here. We're getting into that bathwater potential season here
mm-hmm.
with mid-80s again today mm-hmm. and tomorrow and over the weekend and
mm-hmm. more on that.
And they, more on that.
Other than that, you got the Musky Shop Bash. If you don't know, wow,
mm-hmm. less than 2 weeks away, Steve.
12 days.
Don't remind
oh,
me.
Wow.
Got a if lot you to do.
Know, yeah. So if you want to know, I've got to go. My schedule it just never ends. So I'll be dropping off the boat at Hacienda Leje.
Yep.
So got to get that there. And then from there, mm-hmm. got to go to ICAST, and I'll be rolling right there into the bash. So hopefully I have a report on some of the latest and greatest coming out of the rest of the tackle world here.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. ICAST is a huge show. So,
it is.
Yeah, that's
people ask
that's the
about
big American show.
How big is it? And it's like you don't see all the booths. it's huge.
So you just can't see everything.
No,
it's that
no,
big.
it's about as big of a trade show as one can get. So, you know, it's always interesting. So I'll report on that. It will be hectic. But I think that's where everybody's at in the fishing industry right now. So. It's exciting. Like I said, this is my week for getting it together, Jay. Trying to hold her together here. I got camera gear laying everywhere. I got more tackle than a tackle store.
On top of it, we have filming to do. We got the bash. You're going to be rolling into Wisconsin. You're going to be going straight to Florida. You're going to be coming back to Wisconsin.
then you're going to Canada. And then you got to go. Heck. I was looking at my schedule the other day. There was something in France has popped up. That's exciting. You know, I'm not even kidding.
Not this week, though, right?
Not this week, but
okay.
You know, the itinerary, it just don't quit, Jay. It doesn't mm-hmm. quit. I got France. I got what else? There was some other rando country. It's like, oh, you have to go there now. So, okay. Fantastic. So, anyway. That is the comings and goings, what's going on with me. Obviously, at the shop, got some new apparel in, but we have been naughty monkeys because last week I just wanted to blab. But anyway, we got it. Oh, one thing I want to say, Jay.
What's that?
We got it coming out. We always send the invite to people. And we got Glenn McDonald from 54 Bus. He's going to be there at the bash. I know he's going to come out and film
That's
some
great.
Stuff. And so he's going to come down and hang out, and you can, folks, meet a Canadian. Right?
Okay.
Now, don't, rule number one, don't look them in the eyes. That's a sign of aggression. Right?
Yeah, now, I've heard that.
If your kids are coming, make sure they don't have any syrup left on them from breakfast. Right? Okay?
Ooh. I never heard that one. Okay.
It'll get bit. Okay, that's just, it's just don't have syrup. If you got syrup, say you had a hot cake from the McDonald's on the way over, right? Got a little on your finger, you might lose that finger.
So you're associating with Canadians with primates and wild bears.
No direct eye contact. No residual syrup, right?
Oh, boy.
Try to go.
We just alienated some good people.
Say A as much as possible so they think you're one of them.
Right? Glenn's not coming anymore.
Memorize some hockey stats.
Now that's a good one.
Right? Just have it there on hand. I don't know, Jay. Sorry, whatever. Now he'll be there. What? I pick on Canadians. It's fun. Anyway, now he'll be there and going to come out. He's going to film some stuff, I think, for his channel, and it's always cool to meet and greet. So come out and mingle. That's the one thing. Some people, I actually got a message earlier this week. Hey, I was thinking about coming in. How much does it cost? It's free. We never say that anymore because we assume that people know that. But if you don't know, and me and Jay, again, naughty monkeys, free. So the bash is entirely free. Something to point out as well. Why do we do the bash? So the vibe at the bash is not a typical muskie show. A typical muskie show is here comes everybody. They've paid for their booth. Like, so here's Johnny's walk-a-doodle crawl bait, right? Making up a company here. Johnny's got to show up and he's got to pay to exhibit at the show, right? So he's got to sell baits. He's got to pay for his booth. He's got to get there. He's got to set all his stuff up and hope you come by. And hope you buy a bait so he can break even. And so he's going to be selling you pretty hard. So at the bash, what we do, and we're public about it, all the vendors, they are paid and made in the shade before they even show up or when they show up that morning. So there's no charge to the public. The vendors are already taken care of, so everybody's happy. It's a happy environment. So it's a little bit more laid back. And I always tell people the cool thing about it. That allows the vendors to just kind of be at ease. They're not paying to be there. They've already been paid for the product. And everybody's a happy camper. So there's no hard sales pitches and nobody's antsy and dicey and everybody can have a good time. That's it.
Don't worry about parking either. We've got acres and acres of extra parking that's free as well. So,
The parking's free. The admission's free. You're not going to get the, nobody's trying to pawn off, rainbow pink sparkle leftovers on you.
That's right. Listen, and everything's going to be on sale. Everything. There you
go. What is the sale, Jay?
15% off.
There you go. 15% off. Everything.
And we've got a lot of raffles we're giving away, too, so stick around towards the end. It's a short event. It's 11 to 3,
Right.
And towards the end of the event, probably me, I'll be raffling off a lot of stuff. So
there you go.
When you get on the entrance, you put your name in a bucket. One per entry, please. And there's a really good.
Now, what you don't realize is multiple times Tom Rudis and myself have made up names and put them in the bucket. And Jay has drawn them before, which is always fun. But
I'll be like, okay, winner of the free Frable net is Steve. Okay, forget it. Give me another name. You don't get it. You don't get that, sir.
No. And they're usually off-collar names make their way in there. It's always fun. But no, it like I said, it's a chill vibe. Not your typical show where everybody's, everybody's just chilling. And I always tell people the reason it works out best with like the people that are exhibiting there and all this stuff. They're not trying to sell you. It's a great time to pick their brain, right? Because you get that vibe sometimes at a show. They're like, if you're asking too many questions and you're not buying, it's annoying to the vendors, right? Because they got to move you on and get to the next guy that's got his cash out to buy whatever. And so take advantage of that. Pick their brain. That's what they're there for. You know what I'm saying? If you want to get a little firsthand tips and tricks or some product knowledge, always a cool vibe. And I just, like I said, I encourage you to take advantage of that because it's a rare setting anyway. And then come up with as many like bad names to put in Jay's bucket that he can't read and he's got to stand there and draw repeatedly. Jay,
no, don't do that. Please don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's under, actually, we have a 120-foot tent. Just an immense tent. So, rain or shine, weather's not an issue.
No. It doesn't rain.
Barring tornadoes, but it won't tornado.
Do you get that from rent-a-tent?
Yeah, you know, I don't know where we got it from, but it's a local rental place,
Steve. Tent offensive.
Minocqua tent and steak.
Minocqua tent and taxidermy. They're tent rental and taxidermy and cheesery. Anyway, every year we encourage people to win a random bait. Now here's the thing, Joe. We got to come up. I'm on the fly. I've had no time to plan. We don't plan anything, if you haven't noticed. Anyway, a couple years ago, it was who could make the best macaroni drawing of Joe Bucher. That was amazing.
That was a good one.
Right, that was a good one. Bring a block of cheese and get all the pros to sign it. That was a pretty good one.
It was good. You should see Booker's face when some of the winning macaroni plates got offered to him. He's like,
my favorite one. And if you notice, there's thematically making Booker uncomfortable, I guess. First person to offer Joe Bucher a homemade hard boiled or deviled eggs. Yeah, right. Yeah. Which was, imagine you're out in the sun. Now think about this. Here you are. You're in a parking lot with strangers. And a guy walks up to you with obviously deviled eggs he's brought from home.
Right. We purposely didn't tell Joe Bucher about this. So he was completely, surprised.
Yeah. Talk about awkward situations.
Yeah. It was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Priceless. So,
listen, maybe we make Glenn feel at home, Jay.
Maybe do something for Glenn. Yeah.
The first person, what are we going to do? Don't, hopefully it doesn't listen here. Right? What do you got? So maple syrup. What are we thinking, Jay?
Hockey.
No. First person just comes and cross-checks him right there in the middle. No, Jay. We can't do that. I don't know. I've got an idea in my head, but I can't say it on the podcast.
I understand.
We got to filter. Hold on. I'm filtering through ideas here. Right. First idea is always just so obtuse. First person to offer Glenn your homemade syrup. Mm-hmm. And it's got to look gross. Maybe a mason jar. Just think, whatever.
You got some fresh cranberry syrup here, Glenn. What do you think there is?
So somebody will do it. Just bring your homemade syrup.
Just shock him. Shock him into believing he's in Wisconsin.
Yeah. He'll go, oh, this is my cheese-flavored syrup. Have you a swig.
Yeah. Hey, a little there, cheddar.
It's old country recipe. Huh?
Not bad. Not bad, Steve.
I like the
syrup idea. I think we should run with that.
Mm-hmm. The first idea, if you just stood in front and just started pouring it on yourself.
Yeah.
But then it just goes downhill from there. And then now we got a guy covered in syrup in the parking lot, which is...
It'd be hard getting off him in that heat.
And then the bugs.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, Austin. Hi, Steve and Jay. My question is, when's a good time to fish the channels in a chain of lakes? I fish a chain of lakes in Vilas County. An average depth of the channel is 2 to 5 feet, and I rarely fish them. Just curious on what you think. Also, I was listening to an episode from a few months ago about listening for hours of the podcast. Still can't figure out how to check, but I've listened to every podcast. Oh, okay. I think he's just referring. And he says, can't say enough good things. Cheers. So, Austin, channels in between lakes. So, if you don't live in a place that has channels in between lakes, you will have a chain of lakes, literally, and there will be portage channels, right? Typical, like you said, 2 to 5 feet. You can get to from Lake Suckatobin to Lake No Muskies. and fish them both, and they're interconnected. You just drive your boat. Jay can attest, a lot of times there's a boat ramp kind of right on a portage channel. You turn left, you're turning right, like Sugar Camp and all these different things, right?
Sure. Yes. Yeah,
so absolutely. You might be on lake this and you go to lake that and yada yada. So highly overlooked. Portage channels connecting lakes. People just go, huh. They treat these lakes as if the muskies would never use them. Right? They're like,
they rarely fish there.
Right. He lives in, there is no way he's going to this lake because they're in the nah. It, why? I don't know. You look at them, they give you that vacant stare, right? And tell you they're eating bucktails. I mean, that's just what happens. So these portage channels, the connecting channels, in my opinion, are underfished and highly productive. Why? First and foremost, they offer shallow cover and structure, right? And I'm talking summer fishing here, caveat. So we've got shallow cover and structure. What else do we have in a channel? We often have current.
Yep.
Right? So it is one basin going into another, so that's good. You have a blending nature there, right? So you might have deep channel water, depending on where you're at. And I've actually seen a cooling effect in a channel, right? So, and I'm talking in Wisconsin where I've seen, oh, this one channel is pulling deeper basin water up, right? It's because essentially the water's going downhill or downstream, if you will. And so cooler basin water's coming up and there's a cooling effect in that channel, which was pulling in fish. Current and channels are always going to have an attracting effect on bait fish, right? So what you have is essentially, and bear with me here, you hear all these musky guys all the time, current breaks and neck downs, right? Current yeah. breaks and neck downs. Now, a portage channel is just that, but they don't pay attention to it because there's why I don't know, but there's a disconnect there. So I treat them just like we're looking at neck downs. Now, sometimes that's a very wide neck down, but it has the same effect. So however you want to conceptually approach it, it needs to be fished. It can be at times when it is, when I say not a transitional time as far as seasonality per se, but a weather transition, that's one of the first places I'm going to go. With that being said, I actually reference one of the, and I know where he's talking about because I just remember the podcast. It would be like 5 years ago, 4 years ago. Myself, Jay, Jim, and Josh Krieger, we're filming for videos for the shop, and a cold front came through and the temperature dropped, I want to say 40 degrees, Jay. Remember that? In July?
The first one? It was wicked.
When I say wicked, I mean, I believe I want to say I borrowed, I was having to borrow clothes from people. Yeah. It was cold.
We knew it might rain, so I think we all had rain gear.
No, it
was
just cold.
We had every stitch of, I mean, yeah, it was just cold. Unreal.
I mean, if I could have got my hands on gloves in July, I would have been all over it. Now, right? Not my waterway, but we're out there, and again, I'll pick on him. I love Josh, but I can say, and he was a new guide or a young guide at that time. Josh is kind of calling the shots, and we're like, okay, this, and it's not happening. And we had a discussion. I said, this is what we need to do and why we need to do it. And it's kind of like one of these things like, that doesn't work. And I said, we're doing it, and this is why, right? Well, why did we do that? And why did we make because we're talking, yes, the day before they're cracking off, the day we get there, it's not cracking off, and we need to make a transition. Why did we immediately run to that? Well, at that point, you actually had outflow of the dam systems, right? So the current going through there is consistently driving water and consistently regulating warmth. So all of your shallow edges on the lake, imagine you have your main basin of the lake, and then you have all the shallow edges that everybody fishes, right? That's dropping dramatically in comparison to a place where current's present, because the shallow edges, the vegetative edges, things of that nature, they're going to feel that influx. They don't have anything other than the sun and the wind and the ambient air temperature influencing them. The current doesn't play as hard. So everything pulled out of those and went current derivative because that was where the consistency still was. Right? And we ended up, I think we had a five fish day, Jay, and now there wasn't anything pretty in there. There wasn't like, you know, there was no slobs caught that day, but in that kind of a cold front, it's just derivative of, well, there's always a chance to get bit because everybody else, I think we're like one of the few boats out on the water dumb enough to still be swinging the bat.
And yeah. Have a five fish day. Everyone bailed.
Right. Yeah. Because it's just misery factory. But, you know, sometimes when you're doing projects or videos or you got to test baits or whatever, you got to do it. It's like guiding. You got to be there. But at that point, those portage channels became the most regulated or the most stable place you could be other than the deep water. And that's what's attractive about it. So conditionally, if we have a big cold front and there is moving water, water is going through there. If we have a massive cold front, that's one of the first places I'm looking, right? Secondarily, they're underfished even when conditions are stable, right? You have, especially in a Wisconsin scenario, you've got a lot of boats going through there. You got a lot of, I wouldn't wish it on anybody on a Saturday. Like you go to a freaking Eagle River chain and try to fish that on a Saturday, you're probably just going to get hit in the head with a beer bottle for being in the way. Right. So pick your punch and pick your game plan there. But, you know, there's numerous times where I have made a trip based on fishing those portage channels. Again, cold fronts absolutely come to mind. The other thing is this is you will find muskies that are very much using the edges of those, the entering point and the exiting point of those when they open back up. Right. So you need to treat that as if it's a river mouth because it kind of is. So combine river mouth fishing, which I'm going to fish on either side of it. Now, depending on the current, it can play. Now, dig, if you will, this, Jay. Sometimes you have enough current where you actually have like an inside turn, outside turn, like a buildup of sediment on one side, and you can kind of tell. Like, imagine you're looking at the opening of one of these portage channels, and on the left side it is deeper on the left, and on your right side it's built up, right? You can actually see that there's an inside turn, outside turn just from the composition of the shoreline near these, right? And you can kind of gauge off of that. So what I'm looking for is any telltale sign that'll let me know, okay, which is the current side, which is the slack side of this mouth from main basin current. And then I'm going to fish it like a river mouth, right? And I'm looking upstream, downstream, slack water, moving water, sides of that. And you can actually kind of pattern that. So I've gotten to situations where I go, okay, they're on the slack water side of these channels if there's enough current. So pay a lot of attention and break down the openings that when these come together, and you would call that the beginning of that channel, treat it like a river mouth. Inside of that, basically you're casting and blasting. I've caught a few fish in the middle in the deep eroded stuff. And then you on the exit, it's the same thing. It's another river mouth, right? And we want to look at how they're using the current, because if there is current present or there's flow going on, there will be a preference to current side, slack water side at different times of day. So you have multiple things that you can do in there that's going to get you bit when nothing else will. Anyway,
Jason. Yeah, you remember that? Yeah. You remember that first time? One more. You got that. It was like the first bash. And I think we took out some podcasters. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Or that chain. We went between the lakes. We're coming back. And I'm like, sugar, I was up front for some. I'm like,
there's a
hog all of like 47 just in 3 feet of water. I'm like,
in the portage channel.
Yep. Right in the middle of it.
You know, I was going to say it earlier, which is and you, I'm glad you said that, which is these fish transition between the lakes.
True, right.
Just like you do, you're in your boat. They go, nothing's happening over here, or I want to be over here. If it's connected, they're going to use all of it. So that's something to keep in mind. But yeah, dude, I remember
those
that.
Things are. They're usually loaded with bluegills too. Yeah. You know?
There's a time and a place, and you know, like I said, cold front is my immediate knee jerk of when it happened. But that's another thing is, you know, with those channels, don't be afraid to, you know, early season, look for if you've got brim beds setting up or you have different bait fish setting up. Because the muskies are aware of these channels, they're going to use them. And again, I mean, visually, heck, on that was Sugar Camp Chain J, right there off. That was the ramp right off the road, and it, like you said, 47. I mean, it's just sitting there cruising through, slow as can be, heading from one lake to another. So, you know, pay attention to it, fish it, and the other thing is this: places like that, if you do launch at the in betweens, that's always a heck of a place to end the day too. Right, you'll have them sliding up. Anyway, we got so much. I need to stop here. Jason, question for Steve from Boone County. Well, if you don't know Boone County, Jay, do you know what the Boone County mating call is, Jay?
Is that near you?
Well, it's in West Virginia. So the Boone County mating call is when you shake the pill bottle of Oxycontins.
Oh,
so that is a Boone County mating call. Anyway,
ouch.
West Virginia, by God.
Anyway, America.
He rehabilitated to Hurricane.
That's how you pronounce it, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Hurricane West Virginia. Sure. He's a creaker. Damn, he's got it all going on.
He's got it all.
Damn, man. A man of refinement and class. Woo! In the last several years, I've been lucky enough to catch 5 fish between 51 and 54 inches in West Virginia streams.
Whoa.
Yes, sir. West, by God.
Hello.
These were caught in spring, summer, and fall. 4 came on the same style of bait, large sucker style paddle tails, right? With one on a sucker pattern glider. Question is, especially in the warm months, everyone says you have to go fast, but my luck has been in all seasons and has been due to slowing down to a horrible slow retrieve. What is your opinion? Longtime listener, picks on request. Boy, he ain't playing, Jay. He said, I'll show you.
Anyway, nice. Okay.
Damn. Sorry. You got to talk to him. See, this is why I'm trying to. You see how I talk to people from West Virginia, Jay? You got to talk to people the way they're used to being talked to.
You look them in the eye, too.
Well, but like with Canadians, don't. You see, no, you no, got no, it. No. You got it.
You look at their forehead. Right.
Right. It's like a dangerous.
They're looking up.
Like a dangerous dog. Don't look. No, exactly. You got to talk to people the way that works best.
Anyway, got it.
That's what I'm going to do. But anyway, so. We've got us a guy that's got some big fish, and if you have any doubts, there's big fish in West, by God. So, grew up there, creeked it up. That's where the creeker comes from. And again, there's plenty of big water. There's plenty of big fish and plenty of water there. But the operative thing is slow. That is my game. Always has been, always will be. Right? Now, the comparison is this. He's catching those fish, doing well, obviously, over the course of 5 years, fishing slow. Now, what's my opinion? That's what works on big fish.
Kind of have to agree with you on that one.
So, you know, if we need to go picks on demand, I'm right there with you, which is a disproportionate number of big muskies in the net, you know, whatever timeline we want to look at, that has been not dissimilar from a lot of what I do and what I've preached for years. If you go back, if he's a longtime listener, we go all the way back to, you know, Half Spool Steve, right? fishing, and I still do it. It's a 5-3-1 tranks most of the time. In my hand on the boat is a 5-3-1 tranks with about enough line on it that I can fit my whole thumb on it, and it still fits below the reel seat or below the top of the reel. So I've got about half a spool on a 5-3-1. That's about how fast I fish. And I'm not a power fisherman at all. But when we look at quality of fish, it usually pays off. So this is, Jay, this is like the little book you get from the library, right? Choose your own adventure. What do you want to do? Right? Do you want to be a power fisherman and fish fast, fast, fast and look for those hot fish? Or do you want to pick them out and target them? So schools of thought, and there's nothing wrong with either. I'm not saying power fishing is this, power fishing is that. I'm not saying what I do is this or I'm saying do is that. I would say I'm diametrically opposed, right? Or I'm completely in opposition of the way most people fish or how they want to fish, right? Are there days that I am fishing way too slow and way too deep and missing action? Absolutely. Have I been able to consistently hook into bigger than average fish? Yes. So you've got to pick your poison. Now, I tried to blend, and it's one thing I've tried to work on. And Jay, this is one thing nobody's ever got it right. You know, nobody's ever got it all figured out. I definitely know that I don't, right? First one to admit, I don't know it all, and I still make plenty of mistakes. But an egregious mistake I'd made for years, and you probably hear me therapeutically barf it out on the podcast if I need to pick up the pace and I miss hot windows sometimes, right? Old Lenny Krexbaugh got him 336s, and here I'm coming back on the hunt for Godzilla with nothing, you know? And so I'm trying to take more advantage of when everything points to action, fish appropriately, because this is what I believe, and this is what I'm getting to. Guys pull big fish. People that spend weekends on the water, right? And I'm saying this is not good or bad. There's no opinion. This is just my assessment of time. There are people that go on trips and they spend 2 days on the water and one of them gets a 53. One of them gets a 55, right? Unguided is what I'm saying. Unguided. They go out to some lake and it happens every now and again. Somebody's throwing blades or a top one and they get pigasaurus. That happens consistently enough that you hear it. They might be in the Western Angle. They might be on Eagle. They might be on Green Bay. You will hear consistently enough in muskie fishing, people you'll never hear their name again get one of these big fish. Right? Bigger than average or a scary big fish. Never hear them again. So, you know, Lenny Thompson got a 55 on whatever. Now, did he figure it out that day, or did the muskies do? Were the muskies where he needed them to be, and he ended up where they were? So, what I'm trying to do is go, okay, these are not outliers. These are not guys that no one dumbs into anything. Is what I'm trying to get at, right? But what Lenny was doing, I'm making up names, but what Lenny, this made up muskie fisherman, was doing was the right thing that day, and he was in the right place and fishing most likely fast. Your average guy is going to fish far too fast, and he's going to fish far too aggressive. But when those days line up, that's what the big ones want, that's where you see the catches. Most of the time, and I would say 90, and I'm talking not days, I'm talking time. Hours. My experience has been that 99% of the time, slower is better for big fish. 99% of the time. Right? There was, right when tubes were happening and you know, whatever, we did a lot of damage for people throwing tubes over the years, right? That was kind of the hot new thing there for a minute and yada, yada, yada. And expose a lot of people to it. Still, that entire time, Jay, if you think it on the boat, I'm throwing 5-3-1 with little to no line, just always deeper. Always just a tick deeper. And I exemplify just another time frame or time we're fishing. Mm-hmm. We would have four of us in the boat, three of us on average, 3 to 4, throwing tubes. And I am fishing far slower, which means deeper. And you look at the quality of fish that would come, you know, not a bunch, but a lot of big, you know, big ones. If you had 10 of them, here's a 4-footer, here's a 50 something, here's this, here's that, right?
Well, it also illustrates that you're not running and gunning,
right?
That you're concentrating on areas that,
well, that's, yeah,
that's, that speak volumes that they are musky rich areas. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, that's what I was saying though, but it's like disproportionately, okay, here's, you know, what's the difference, right? What's the difference? And like, to the point, and it's like, even at that point, and I'm talking like when we went out with Frosty, that time frame and all that stuff, right? We were trying to give all the guides a shot to do a video and all that. Mm-hmm. Like Jim, we called him the Tube Screamer. The reason we gave him the nickname the Tube Screamer is you've never seen somebody work a tube as fast and hard as anybody. Like he could, it's screaming through the water, right? Uh-huh. And he was catching fish. But you look at some of the big ones and then you went, okay, that thing. And Jay, you see where I'm going. It's like, okay, who caught fish? Who caught volume? But who caught biggest? Slower caught biggest. Faster caught volume. That's what I'm getting at. That is, again, all I have is anecdotal experience. All I have is what I've done on my boat and seen with my eyes. But what I'm getting at and what I've always thought is a slower, more plotty, more, I don't want to say finesse because nothing in musky fishing is finesse, but give me the latitude, is slower, finessier, less aggressive retrieves tend to catch the most big fish. Right? That's where I'm at. You know,
sure.
It seems to work. I rarely have that story of Hogosaurus. You know, so Jason, I'm at 100% agreeance with you with that massive caveat of do not look past the conditions. And that was a flaw that I had. I think I fixed it. We'll see. But a flaw that I had was, regardless of how juicy it looked, I still was like, oh, I gotta do it a little bit. I gotta be right up on the stuff. I gotta be like picking it apart. I need to be more systematic, right? And there is a time, because you have, like, I was making up the fake names, you know, Joey Buttkiss caught a 53 running and gunning. Balance, right? Because a lot of times what you want to do is you want to say you got this thing licked, you got it figured out, right? And there's no figuring out. It's like, I'll figure out today. That's the difference, is figure today out. You haven't figured out everything. So what is today and what does today call for? So do not overlook fast and aggressive. But on an average, slower, deeper, more pinpointed targeting is going to get you bigger fish. And like you were saying, Jay, though, to that point, and I'm going through it in my head, as many big ones as I can think of, most of them are saturation casting fish, too.
There you go. I think
most that of was, my big ones.
That was something I enjoyed out of last week's episode, mm-hmm. where we were talking about patterning, and we're talking about, it's just like every lake has 3 to 4 spots of fish. That's it. No more. Those 3 to 4 spots and concentrate in on. And yeah, most of the time any of us are out, you know, conditions are less than ideal. So
there's more. Let me say, and this does not play to inland Wisconsin. The right, there's a lot of small bodies of water. Your 500 acre lake, I'm not saying this, but larger bodies of water, right? That there's a, like, if I go in the Shield, there's a big one, at least with it. There's a 50 inch muskie within 100 yards of you at all times. Unless you're out in the middle of, heck, the scope has proved some of them are out in the basin, right? But you're close to a 50 at all times.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Right? And my thought has always been, and God, I'm down a rabbit hole to hell with it. My thought has always been, Well, am I gonna get in front of the one I'm close to now, or am I just hope the other one is where I need it to be? I mean, it's two schools of thought. The way I approach it entirely is boring. I get it. You know, it's not a sightseeing trip. It is, well, I know there's a 50-incher near me. Where is he? Within my little sphere of where I'm at. Is he on the top of the reef? Okay, probably isn't right now because these are the conditions. Would he be off the reef? Well, there's no bait off the reef. Okay, what would a play? Oh, there's bait fish that are mid, and we. You see where I'm going at? I'm not going, is there a big one here? No, there is. 100%. And maybe, and like when I say these little inland lakes, a big fish on some of these things is 45, so it might as well be a 50. What does it matter?
Yeah.
Right?
If you're 20 yards off the, right. If you're 20 yards off the big fish, you're
it's
not
all
gonna
scale.
Catch it.
It's all, you know, zoom in, zoom out on your phone. That's, I'm so glad it exists for people now where you can talk about scale. You're zooming in, you're zooming out. You're zooming in, you're zooming out. Well, if I get in my boat on, say, Eagle, right? And I'm going to drive from Wendigo Island to Andy Myers. A lot of guys have made that drive. That's what I said. How many 50-inchers did I drive by? How many? Somebody tell me.
Mm-hmm.
How many did I just drive by? Why? And if you think about it, and I'm just here it is. Nail it on the church door like Martin Luther. Why are you driving by them? Because you want one to be on a spot you know. You want one where you want it. You want it where you want it. That's the breakdown for a lot of people is, oh, there's biggins on Coleman's Reef. Or, and when I say here's the, you know, community spot or this, that, and the other, or you're driving by muskies nonstop. On good musky water, you're driving by them. Why are we driving? Is that one not good enough? Do you need him in the weed bed so you can catch him? Do you need him in 2 feet of water off a rock so you can catch him? I don't get it. That's the concept for me. And that also goes down to slowing down and how we're presenting. So if I've established that forage is there, muskies are there, why am I running away from them? Why am I going to the next bay over in hopes that the one in the next bay over is up shallow for my bucktail? Right? Or why am I not going, hey, it's not, and that's why I don't look at it as spots. I look at it as, I mean, a lake's a system and everything in between is connected, right? You can't go from weed bed A to weed bed C. They're connected. There's something out there, right? Whether it's main basin or whatnot. So even from a standpoint of how you're changing areas or how you're targeting them. And again, I feel like I've ran into a disproportionate amount of big fish over the years, whether it be casting or trolling, from absolute saturation and thoroughly covering something that should be productive, right? And again, I think it's more beneficial. I hope if I say that, the guy's next question might be like the best question ever. But to stay on the rabbit hole on this, which is this. Let's imagine we have established that a point should be holding muskies based on conditions, seasonality, and forage, right?
Mm-hmm.
You go into the point and you fish the shallow edge and then you move on. It's what everybody does. They fish the top of it. They fish the visible section. They fish vegetation if it's there, and they move on. They've done the hard thing and gone, the bait's here. The conditions say they should be here. And they come up and cast, and they go, okay, what's the next spot? Why? You know, why? You went into a restaurant. You ordered your whole meal. You ordered, appetizer, a salad, and an entree. And you ate the apps and you walked out, you know, well, why?
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we not fishing the whole thing? Because we've established baits here. Everything says muskies should be here, but we've made little to no attempt to target them in hopes that the next place that we target, they are where we want them to be. There's the mental thing where again, this started with the slow speed thing, but a slow retrieve only in one area doesn't work either. So it's why you need to look at situations, for lack of a better term, and I say an area for a reason. Like when I go in to fish a thing, what everyone would call a spot, it needs to be considered an area, because a spot is what you see. The area is the interconnectivity of that. And if you're not taking advantage of that, what are we doing? So if you combine methodical coverage with methodical retrieves, that's how you get big fish, at least in my book, in my theoretical book. I don't mean an actual book. I've never written a chapter on how to catch big fish, because, I mean, targeting them is a whole other thing. It's like, you know, I've always slightly called fooey on targeting them. I guarantee this Jason Feller, he's had the same experience. In his quest on those big fish, he's caught a lot of fish in between, and they're usually not dinks, right? You're usually going to see that habit of bigger fish, whether it be conditioning or what's staging for them. Anyway, I'll get out of the rabbit hole, Jay. I'll get out of it. Tyson, fishing southern Wisconsin, just started musky fishing last season, landed a 46 within the first few trips on a bucktail, but so far that's been the only musky. Just curious, maybe you guys have some idea of where I should be focusing my time on, maybe some baits for high current. I mainly float a small river which spans about 100 to 150 foot wide and flows pretty quick. Deepest spots are 6 to 8. Oof. With the average being a 3 to 4 with lots of weeds, rocks, trees. Saw lots of muskies on a scouting trip during spawn, so the numbers there just can't seem to connect. So, this is cool. Because, Jay, when it's flowing fast, guess what you can't do? Get great coverage, right? So.
Yep, you're moving quick.
Rivers. Right. And we were talking about being a creeker earlier. I grew up fishing, moving water, and I'll die fishing, moving. Hopefully, I'd theoretically die fishing, moving water. Not, I don't want to die on a river is what I'm trying to say, Jay.
Okay, gotcha.
Gotcha, check. Let's clear that up for everybody.
Yep. So,
if anybody's taking requests. But I love moving water. That is a core thing that I've always done. And we've broke down a few times here, but let's go after it. We are looking for flow, and we're going to evaluate what the current is doing, right? You need to read the water, and it's a different reading of the water than reading water conditions. You're looking at the water and going, okay, this is moving how many cubic feet per second or rate of flow or whatever you measure it in. What's that doing, and how is that going to impact, first and foremost, forage staging? And how is that forage staging going to influence where muskies choose to be?
Yeah.
The disconnect that people have fishing rivers is they make an evaluation of, again, good spots, but it's based on that day. So what I'll see when we're drifting or we're fishing is guys will be like, oh, here's the Stidham hole, here's old Tommy's hole, here, you know, everybody's got some goofus name for this. Oh, Willie's Bent Branch, whatever. They'll find, through hook or crook, you'll find productive areas, and they will fish them repeatedly in the same manner in quote-unquote productive holes. I just said that out. Sorry. Productive holes, Jay. Right. But that's what they'll say about areas on a river. And one has to look at it and go, at that rate of flow. Well, that's a great hole to hit at that rate of flow, right? There should just be the dry voice at the end of that statement for river fishing. Well, that's great at that rate of flow. Okay. Muskies reposition continually in moving water.
Sure.
Continually. That's the one thing that's over everybody's head. So if you find a quote unquote spot, it's the same animal we were just unpacking, or I was just going down the rabbit hole. How does this play? Well, a muskie is looking for a predatory advantage. You've got to consider, is that slack water no longer going to be productive because it doesn't offer him enough area to stage? Does it offer, you know, is there obstructions? And we're looking at how the water is setting up, right? If it's ripping, like, you know, the change in the velocity of flow, the rate of flow is going to, again, augment where the bait fish are, and it's going to augment how the muskies set up, and they're going to set up where they have an advantage. That's all I'm getting at. So if you're fishing moving water, you need to document weather. You need to document the rate of flow and then consider. So what will happen? Slow rate of flow in a river, it decompresses, right? So muskies can use more of it effectively, right? A slower flow expands bait fish, and so it decompresses population density in areas even, right? So let's take it sections. You often hear about sections of a river. So,
right.
You're not going to have a movement of muskies in a river often. I mean, they're big often here. You can have massive migrations, but in general, they have their stretch that they'll utilize. As long as that stretch offers them structural and cover elements that are advantageous year-round.
Trees are great.
Trees are solid. Trees are always good, but I'm saying structurally. Okay, well, structurally, what do we need? We need things that break current and that provide them refuge from the current. We need things that set up and allow them to have ambush points and also to visual reference.
Seams
and things of that nature. I believe that river muskies are far more visual, right? If you think about it, how well can they see? How can a muskie really differentiate the thump of a paddle tail, right, swim bait to a bucktail or whatever it might be? It's coming downstream and it's getting bounced off of rocks and ricocheted. There's a million vibrational deflection points in moving water, whether it be rocks, whether it be timber, whether it be this. River fishing is visual fishing. In my opinion, I could be wrong. I don't think I am. But in moving water that actually has a good clip, it's moving a mile, 2 miles an hour, things of that nature, and up from there, that's a visual.
And up from there, yeah, and that's producing noise too.
And I've fished plenty of stuff that's moving fives and sixes.
I know.
And that's a whole other animal.
That's moving.
That'll wake you up. And I enjoy it, always have, because what will happen in moving water, actually it goes back to threw Dr. Bob in the little boat and said, here we go, sucker. You ain't in Minneapolis anymore, boy. Get in, right? And there's a couple areas where Jay, I'll sit there and go, hold on. And you do a 360 no scope, hit your head off of a bush and spit out the other side, right? You can't even control the boat is what it is. I'm serious, right? Okay.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just the truth of the matter. You have, but what is boat control? No, we're about to spin around a bunch. Hope you don't get sick because we're going through a rapid or whatever it might be. So what will happen in moving water is quick visual read, assessing what you're looking at, and then picking the right shot with the expectation that you're getting close enough that he can see it. I'm not worried about feeling it as much. There is obviously a vibrational thing, but I believe they have to see the bait. Unless we're in really deep hole or in a calm pool, it is put that bait where he expects it to be coming from. That's what I'm getting at here. A muskie on a river of truly moving water is set up where he expects his food to be coming from and delivered to him.
And he's not going to be sitting in high current because they don't like to fight.
They don't want to fight it. That's a waste of calories. Therefore, it is inefficient. Yep. Therefore, they do not do it. Mark it off your box. Don't waste a cast. I'm sure somebody's got, well, I don't care. Right? Don't care. Yeah, I hear, Jay, it's like frickin' at a certain point, I've said it, there's no IQ test for a fishing license, which is, you know, you go, the most of the dots are red, but there's a blue one. Okay, got it. Talking averages here. You know, calm down.
Yeah, you are. That's true.
But yes, don't care about your outlier on the curve there. But hold on, boop, nope, stop. But anyway, what you'll see in this moving water scenario is if you deliver your bait in a manner that makes sense, you're going to have more action, right? Is it darting at the end of a tree limb? Is it slicing? Is it cutting the current sideways in front of a rock that he's most likely to be behind as a current break, right? You can't expect them to double back, turn around, and chase your bait downstream. You have to be watching and reading the water and making the most logical cast at all times. And a lot of my fishing that I've done over the years, you get one shot, two at best, right? The top edge of a slack water area, right? Because even the slack water's moving on, or the current's taking you by it. Is he at the head of, and you're patterning it all at once too. Is he at the head of the slack water, or is he in the tail end of the slack water? Oh, we got to follow off the tail, the end part of the slack water, right where the current break edge of the seam is. Well, the next time you're going to your next section or your next area, right, as the water takes you and you can't really fight back up or fight back down or whatever it might be, you need to be planning your cast for what that next section is, because that's how you're building a pattern, right? You're not taking pop shots. And what happens on moving waters, people take pop shots. Oh, there's a cast over here. Oh, here's a cast over there, right? I'm pretty much convinced that in most moving water scenarios, I need a boat and a spinner bait. Right? Why a spinnerbait? It's not going to snag up, and I can actually be probative with it and make pretty brazen casts. And that's what I'm getting at. It's a lot of people that do start fishing waters, moving water. They want to throw everything, and you go, well, if it matches the size and the profile, I'm probably good. Right? You can get pretty dialed in with stuff, but I'm narrowing my tackle box immensely in moving water. Where there's days where I can go out there with a Plano flat and I go, I got this, and this. But, you know, I'll be thinking of like just a safety pin spinnerbait. I'm going to be thinking about a Mustang. I'm going to be thinking about a small dive and rise. You know, I've said it before, the Titan Junior was built for fishing a small river systems. But I am really picking my shots. That's number one in on a river, is do not make a cast unless you have a reason to make the cast. Mm. Right. That's the best tip I can give you. Why are you throwing there? And I'll ask guys a moment, why'd you cast there? Why? If, you know, and I'm not really being gruff with anybody. I'd never say it like that, but I'm going to go, why? Well, and I'll be like, I would have cast there, and here's why, right? Don't cast there, cast here. And so you start seeing the staging of these things.
And you start seeing the more obvious areas where muskies are going to be, as opposed to just trying to cover water.
There you go. Because you can't cover water. And you're essentially, it's essentially the adverse. We're talking about breaking something down through ultimate saturation. We no longer have that ability. So the last rabbit hole was, why are we coming up to a point and we're not fishing it thoroughly? Now on really moving water, 2-3 miles an hour with, you know, limited troll. I mean, if you got your troller on 10 to hold you in that stuff all day long, you're not going to last very long. And he's talking about a river that comes up to 3s and 4s. You're going to rip it off your boat, right? You're going to hit a rock real good, and that'll be the end of that one. It's the complete other side of the coin of how you have to target a river, because you're not running and gunning. You are actually picking your shots. Now, again, I was talking about, well, I can't believe that people fish a point this way or fish a lake this way. In my brain, a river is the same thing of, okay, why are you casting there? The same thought is, there's no thought process now into looking downstream. Where am I about to be? If I hold off for 3 seconds, I can make that cast. If I sit here and I just wait and I give it X, Y, and Z, I can make that cast, because you know, you throw the bait out there and you're reeling it in, and here goes the best target right by you. And it's going to be, you're going to be working hard or unable to get back to that target, depending on what you're moving. And so that's what you need to do. Now, if it's slow river or it's not moving really fast, you still need to be doing that. because they're going to set up the same way. So fish are going to set up in an advantageous way. Think visual, right? And think getting right off of stuff. Where should he be? He is behind a rock that's breaking the current, and he's expecting something to go over his head this way. He's set up behind that tree trunk because it's breaking the current, and he's looking for something coming off the bank or coming out of the channel into that, right? It's set up on a courage scene. You know, so think of it as a food delivery system. The muskies are going to let the food come to them, and they're going to snap at it pretty dang fast. That's the other thing. Jay.
Yeah.
Jim says this, Jay. Surface temperatures was at 80 degrees on a Minnesota Metro Lake July 3rd. This is too early. Now what?
It'll cool down.
Pickleball, Jim. Pickleball. A lot of way to meet other people. You can get out and play pickleball. It just depends. I actually asked Dr. Bob about water temps, and this is not uncommon. The metro gets pretty hot pretty fast. Watch your water temps. I'd say early in the year, it's superficial. Skimmer reads, right? Go out early or go out late. That's going to be your best thing, especially in Minnesota. Wind is coming. It's always windy, Jay, in some capacity out there. So hopefully you'll get a little bit of temp knockdown, but go early, and by early, I mean 4.
Yeah, right away.
Yeah, go out there and fish till an hour after sunrise if you really want to get mad at one, or, you know, go out late. And a lot of times you'll have that temperature drop up, but I'm saying that early deal. A lot of times, Jay, I don't know if you know this, at night, the sun's not out.
Yeah, the sun's not warming the water.
Okay.
Never thought of that.
I just realized it scared the hell out of me. But long story short, is a lot of times it'll be still hot in the evening because that sun thing's there. But if you give it the overnight to cool down, you'll find a good opportunity in the morning. Because a lot of times, I mean, by 10, bam, we're right back to that 80 mark. But I've gone and hit stuff, especially living in the South. I start playing water temp shenanigans some years in April already. You're like, oh, God. So I know the feeling, and you have to adjust your schedule, obviously for the health and safety of the fish, but you can get out there early or take up pickleball. There's that.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
What else?
Hate to say it, right?
Yeah, but like I said, I mean, I get freaked out. Yeah, you know, I don't even put it this way. Like the transom transducer on my boat, I mean, that thing is, they're worthless. I'm sorry. Right? Okay, it'll be like 4 degrees hotter or colder. Who knows?
We're talking about the upper range of the water, too. Yeah, check. So, you know,
don't get freaked. I hate to say this, but if it's a skimmer temperature read and it's like 80 and you started and it was 77, it's probably a little superficial. Where I get really concerned, or I get, ooh, we shouldn't be doing this. If I drop my trolling motor and I drop, say, like my live scopes over the boat, and that gives me 3 different positions, right? So you have 3 temperature reads at 3 different depths. And it's like, oh, 80, 80, 79. That's when I'm like, oh, not good, right? So I'm not saying to do anything, but it is early in the year. Consider, is that just the absolute surface? If it is not, I don't recommend it. If it is, okay, go out there in the early morning. It won't be any concern there. Zach went out fishing the Yahara River in Wisconsin. We put it on the south side of the dam and float the river. Me and my buddies have seen good numbers of muskies and good sized fish. We've thrown everything from single and double baits, jerk baits, small rubbers, and swim baits. We haven't had one fall or caught a fish in the last year that we fish that section of the river. The river is generally clear, and you can see the fish off for a ways. So you can see structure, usually the rocks or down branches. The river is littered with carp, and sometimes the muskies set in with the carp. The fish seem to have no interest in what we're throwing. The fish also seem to be lazy and set on the bottom in a hole and do nothing. What would you suggest we need to do in order to get the fish attention? Love the podcast and all the information y'all provide. Thank you, Zach. Okay, refer to the earlier question about the river.
Yeah.
But we've been out there. We've thrown single and double baits, jerk baits, glide baits, small rubber baits, swim baits. Well, they're on cranks. I'm sure he's thrown crankbaits. It's the only thing he left off. So we've thrown it all, and they're not moving. Well, is there pressure? Right? That's one thing to consider. Is there pressure in that area? I don't know it. Jay, do you know where the Yahara is?
Yeah. Yeah, vaguely. I can't say I've really fished the Yahara River, though.
Is there pressure in that area? Is that around Madison? Where is it?
Yeah, it's around Madison.
Okay, yeah, okay. So you're not the first guys out there. That's one thing I would consider. Right. I think there's a couple people in that neck of the woods that own a musky bait. Right? So when muskies, and I'm talking, they don't look at it at all. Right? The answer to this, Zach, could be there is some magical bait that just turns them from absolute logs in the water that won't look anything to voracious. Possibly. I doubt it highly. I would say that a systemic of they've seen a lot of baits over the years, right? Or they're seeing pressure. And so I'm trying to think
of that river stretch.
Right. If it's accessible.
I'm sorry. He's probably talking between Monona and Wabisa.
Okay, yeah.
It's a pretty long stretch. And then, again, that's basically a long channel which connects a chain of lakes.
There you go.
I have fished that with a really, really good fisherman before, and we did not fish that river basically at all. We just transitioned from Monona to Wabisa that particular day. And maybe it's something to do with I'm assuming he's fished it under different conditions, like, you know, overcast versus sun. Because sometimes sun, they might just be doing that lazy thing out there, and they're just not attracted or going to
– well,
you're not going to get them to move, you know, for anything and if it's not cloudy. Right.
Yeah, you've got sections of that, Wabisa and Zach. You nailed her. Yeah, so you're coming out of Wabisa. I don't know if it's Mendota to that. Whatever. Anyway, assume pressure. That would be my number one. Right, we're right there. I would assume pressure, and I would be going late. Right, and I would also just go, you know, I would be weekdays if you can do it, and I would avoid the weekends. I'd go weekdays, and I would try to basically, I mean, when it's high pressure stuff, right? I mean, high angling pressure. Make sure that you're not throwing stuff that's going to be common, right? Because, I mean, right there, and if you've not been Madison, beautiful town, Jay, I've actually sat there and eaten a taco and watched a guy catch about a 37, right by the Capitol. You know, you're sitting there, you look down the street, oh, he's got one. There's a lot of muskie fishing going down. So pressure's going to be a thing, and essentially going down to, well, what is everybody gonna pick up and throw him? Okay, blades, forget that mess, right? Okay, he's gone through the tackle box. What can we do that's different, and how can we make sure, if we're in a high pressure area like that, how are we presenting differently? Well, unless there's an absolute magic bait, different is going to be timing, right? Can you get out there super early, or can you fish it in the dark? I'm going to address it from that standpoint, right? And go from there. I mean, that Jay, what were you adding there? Because I was looking at the map. What else would you think would kind of kick that up? Or is it pressure, or what's your thought?
Well, big boats move back and forth all day long on that, you know. And so get off the channel and fish the edges more. So, you got wake boats going through there, just basically churning everything up. So get outside that little boating channel area, and hopefully the fish are more responsive out there. I've never fished it much at all. I'm trying to think if my buddy even, you know, stopped to fish some areas on the way to Wabisa, because Wabisa is such a good lake, and Monona's turned into an immensely great, you know, productive lake too for big muskies. So
cool. Hold on. All right. We missed that one. the guy said, hold on. We have an apology for Richard, who sent an email forever ago. He'll be on the Chippewa Flowage 5 days starting Monday in advice. Sorry. Hope it went well. Our apologies. We didn't see we had a timely one in there, Jay. Let's do one more.
Sometimes we try. Okay.
Marquette, Mike, how would you set up the perfect 16-foot aluminum side console predator fishing boat? I recently received a free 1982 Alumacraft that was left in an open field for the last 15 years. I've stripped it down to the ribs, and I'm replacing the transom and rebuilding the engine. After that, I'd like to set the boat up for me and my two boys, 11 and 13, to musky fish, northern pike, around Rhinelander, Eagle River, and the UP.
Nice.
He actually spelled it D-A-U-P. I like it. What recommendations would you make on deck layout, storage, trolling motor, imaging, or whatever you think is important, doing all the work myself, no custom fabrication, shop work? I love it. I've rebuilt boats. I've actually done them in the backyard here at the house in the early days of my guide career. There's nothing more rewarding than that as a side project, Jay. It's a good one. And I actually stripped an 18-footer one time down to the ribs. That was a tremendous amount of work. Anyway, we're going to rig this thing up, 16-foot side console, and we got two boys. Plus, they're from the Midwest. They're going to be probably big, hardy Norwegian boys, right? Who knows? What I'm getting at is this space. You're going to need to maximize casting space, right? So in a 16-footer like that, what I'm going to look to do, and I actually kind of did this. I built the deck out one time on a Deep V 16. So I have the side console. You're sitting there.
Yeah, that
red
one?
Mm-hmm. And it's all deck except for a little square. You have your driver's seat, and you have a place for people to sit with their bench and their legs sitting in there. So you have made a place for somebody in the middle, someone in the back. So the whole back is decked up to the back of the driver's seat. And you just have a cutout square. So essentially your little side deck there is a bench. And then somebody stands up and casts. Maximize your fishing space. Right? Period. If you build the deck out like this, that would create space up under it. That's where you can use Plano flats. Or like me, I'm cheap and I got too many baits to move around. Go to the dollar store. Get you a dollar plastic box. You know, whatever. If you're starting out or bush leaguing it. That's going to be the best way to do it. So you want to, that provides you the most casting deck you can get, right? Think about casting deck. How much?
Yeah, front and back.
The whole thing.
Let's say you got both boys back
all
there. You want it comfortable, so when they set the hook and they take a step backwards, they're not stepping into a hole or some kind of missing area, right? You know,
when to be honest with you, like Jay with my boats now, that's a lot of thought of that, which is like, how much casting deck can I get? I mean, we're talking musky fishing here, and much less he's doing Rhinelander, Eagle River, UP. You're not going to be taking hours and hours and hours of long rides, right? And true. I mean, my boat right now, I have a big boat, but it is a two-seater. Two seats, that's it. And the reason I have two seats is for more fishing space. So maximize the deck, everything will work out. In a boat of that size, if we're talking about any kind of storage, like I said, build it like you're building a deck or you're building platforms. It's all interconnected. You can put everything up underneath that back deck and the side deck. You're going to have your life vest to be legal. You're going to have your fire extinguisher to get legal, right? You can put it all up under the back deck. All your tackle storage, right? You can only throw one bait at a time. So
have batteries.
Boxes, right? But there you go. Your batteries go under the deck. Everything goes under the back deck or your front deck or however you're decking it out. Storage up under there for all the crap you don't want to see. For a trolling motor, this is the rule with all trolling motors. Buy the biggest, most powerful one you can afford. That's
it. Go big.
Go big. Yep. Do not get a single 12-volt trolling motor, right? Let's say your two boys end up being NFL linebacker size by the time they're sophomores in high school. The 12-volt, 45-pound thrust ain't going to do it. If it's too windy, it's not going to do it. Get at least a 24-volt. If you can afford the 36, get it, but minimally a 24-volt, 80, 100-pound, whatever you can get your hands on. I don't know what the specs are right now, but get the most powerful trolling motor you can afford, period. That's it, because you don't have to worry about the battery running out, and you don't have to worry about can we fish or can we make it home. That's what a lot of people don't consider, is I want extra battery capacity in case you have an engine issue, yada, 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 right? So
yeah,
deck space is most important to store all the crap, because I'm literally reorganizing my rig right now, Jay, and it's just the same stuff. Ugh, I got to put all the life vests somewhere. Ugh, I have to put all the fire extinguishers. Right? So you got this whole bunch of crap you have to have, ropes, anchors, all this stuff. Then you got all the tackle you want to bring. On a boat of that size, one thing I'd recommend is this, to outrig it the best, and so you're not worried about storage, is you're not going to
get... Rig it so everything's stowed away.
Stowed away. There you go. But you're going to have to transport rods and all this stuff, right? It's actually what I do on my boat, because I have trolling on there. I have casting on there. I actually use a system with just Velcro straps that are off the side. And it's pretty slick. It's actually mounted onto the side. And if I need to move or I'm going down the road, it literally just ship, ship. It's like a deck. You know, you'll see in the bass boats, they have these rubber things that come across and hold their rods down. I just do it against the gunwale on my boat. And you can lay the rods in there. Or if you're going to travel with the rods in your truck or something of that nature, just put some vertical rod holders on there. Right? Just, okay, boys, we're going to move spots, and they're going to sit down. Have a vertical rod holder in the back, and they go pop, pop. They stick their rods, excuse me, in there, and you're just going down the lake down. They're not going to come out. Right? So maximize that. If we're doing homebrew and we're building it up, you know, if money's not an option, go crazy on the electronics. If we're going for minimal, go to any, I mean, you can get a really quality right now, all in one fish finder. Lowrance has, and it's the Eagle i9. Jay, I don't know if you're aware of this.
Nine inch.
Right. Yeah. But the Eagle Eye, they were actually demoing an iCast last year. I saw it. I think it came out right before that, but I saw the demo. It is mapping and live imaging all in one. And I believe it has side scan. I could be wrong on that. Or you can have a second transducer for side scan. So you could get everything for $800. You could have all the electronics and... You know, it's not going to be, you're not going to be less than, you know, you could have access to all that stuff. Or, you know, you can obviously, if you're going over the top and you want to buy it, go crazy, go crazy. But minimally on a boat, what I would like to have for me to feel confident that I can go out and fish, I want quality maps and I want quality downscan. So, you know, you could get a used unit for nothing that does that. They've had quality maps and downscan now for the last decade. But for a few hundred dollars more, you could get an all-in-one Lowrance. I'm not a Hummingbird guy. I will tell you this, and I've a controversial statement. Hummingbird does not have the R&D budgets that Lowrance, which is Simrad, if you don't know this. So Lowrance and Simrad have government contracts, and Garmin has government contracts and massive R&D departments, right? Where Hummingbird is a little bit more lacking into the developmental front. They're actually playing catch up on a lot of stuff now. So if it were me, I've had Hummingbird in the past, not knocking them. I just look at it from that standpoint. Case in point is how much they're still struggling to play catch up on their live imaging stuff.
Okay.
Right. So from the standpoint of technology that is going to be usable, so you just, and this is just for fish finders, period. And I don't change my graphs, by the way. I haven't changed my electronics. I have not like gone out and changed systems now in 3 years, Jay, because I know my stuff and we've plateaued, right? We're at a place in fishing tech right now. There's more coming down the pike. But right now, most companies have caught up. They have live imaging. Everyone has side scan, down scan, live imaging and mapping, right? I just go for product support and ease of use. So I would look at Lowrance or look at Garmin, and then the sky's the limit, but all of them have affordable versions as thereof, where you can get an all-in-one unit that's going to cover a lot of bases. That's just my take. Sorry, I know there's a lot of people in the Midwest that love Hummingbird. Like I said, they're just kind of lacking on that front. If I'm going to get an all-in-one, I'll admit Hummingbird has the best side scan, you know, at current, but that's it. But get something that does as much as you can. Even in a boat of that size, you're not going to have a lot of room for a lot of graphs. The only other thing I'd say is this, if I'm rigging that boat of that size, save some room for at least a small fish finder up front, right? So let's say you got $1,000 budget for fish finders or electronics on the boat, 1,000. you can get away with getting like the most feature pack console unit you have, right? Or the most feature pack this. I'm going to go with the most feature packed unit I can put in the front of the boat. And I'm going to go with a minimalistic mapping down scan at the console, right? If budget's an issue. You could probably get it done on the used market for $1,000 or cheaper. Not cheap, excuse me, $1,000 and maybe a little bit more, excuse me. Or, you know, I would have zero qualms with a, like a Lowrance HDS Gen 2, right? I ran those as a guide for years, ran all over Canada as a guide with those things. There's some guys that I swear by them. I don't have any anymore, but you can get nobody wants them. And that's a rock solid map and downscan. Right, you could get that on the boat, bam. Now you've got really good mapping, really reliable downscan at the console. Again, you could do the same thing for a mapping unit and downscan from Hummingbird, or a mapping unit and a downscan side scan from Hummingbird, or any of them, and then save the majority of your electronics budget for the best unit you can put in the front of the boat, because most likely with two young boys, you're going to do a lot more casting than trolling, but you can still troll really effectively with just maps and downscan. So spend your money at the fish finder level, or the front, you know, where your trolling motor is, so you have the most information while you're casting. What else?
Yeah.
My other fear is this. Got to rebuild the engine, set up there for 15 years. Rebuild it yourself, unless you're an auto mechanic or a marine mechanic. Maybe take it to somebody before you fire it up. I've seen a lot of guys spend a lot of time on boat engines they thought they had right, and then blow them up or mess them up on maiden voyages. Okay. Yeah, that's one thing. Is maybe you take it to somebody right? Hey, I want to pay you for an hour to give it the once over.
Yeah,
unless you're experienced, dude might be super experienced, but you know, have it give the boat the once over. Other comments on this whole front when it comes to boat rigging, which is something I've been dealing with this week. Yay. Your wiring. Keep it simple so you can fix it on
the fly. Accessible. Yeah. Yep.
There you go. Yeah. Simple and accessible. Okay. How's the fish fire wired? From the battery to the fish finder with one fuse.
Yeah, there you go.
Right? Keep it simple. Oh, what went wrong? Well, the wire's bad or the fuse is bad. You know, holy crap. I mean, I told Jetty, I said, I am to the point with my boat of it is so, I mean, I've got I don't have any, like this iteration here, I don't have any analog in the boat at all, like tachometers or fuel or any of this stuff. And I'm sitting there going, okay, I don't know if I could wire this boat anymore. It's crazy, you know?
So, sure.
Like, got a digital screen in the middle, and it's like, man, I hope
just like vehicles.
Yeah. Right. And I'm sitting there going, I hope nothing goes wrong.
Right.
So if I'm rebuilding something, keep it simple. And again, like to Jay's point, keep it accessible. One thing I loved on Jody's boat, on the back.
The gray squirrel.
And that's actually pink. And it's actually, but you call it the pink squirrel. I'm sure that sounds like sounds like a gentleman's
squirrel.
So. Oh, I forgot. Yeah. You're right. She did. That was before. Yes, she did. But nonetheless, the pink squirrel sounds like a gentleman's establishment. Anyway, on the back of her boat, and she's got a low like I do, on the back of her boat, there's a cable run for transducers and your power to the engine and all your engine send wiring back and forth.
Right.
But it's on the top of the deck. It doesn't go through the thing. So it's like this little doop, doop. Like a little step up that's part of the deck that you can screw up or you can unscrew it, right? And you've lost this about 3 inches off the side of the boat is all, but it's like, oh my goodness, if you need to access something 4 screws later and you've got your throttle cables, your shifter, everything's right there. It's like there's none of that bad digging through the boat stuff. And that's one of the slickest ways I've seen it done, where it's like, whoa, that looks aesthetically pleasing and it's highly useful. So think about that when redoing the boat is, okay, at some point you or one of your boys or heck the next owner, if you end up selling it, somebody's going to have to get in there and fix something you're doing now. It'll probably be you. So do it in the most accessible way. It's one of the most important things on the boat build. Oh, Jay, we almost cut up on Q&A. Almost.
getting there. Okay.
But they have rung the dinner bell.
Yeah, me too.
I'm out. I'm hungry, and I got to get ready to come up for the Muskie Shop Bash, July 18th in the Muskie Shop parking lot.
Be there.
Be there or be skinned alive at sunrise.
Elmer's going to be there.
Good night.
Later. All right, guys. Thanks. Bye.